At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire. But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire.
Good morning and welcome to Playing with Fire, Long Island's only food, wine, and lifestyle show. I'm your host, Tom Shortell, and I'm here broadcasting to all you foodies out there. Sitting here with producer and co-host, Stu Schrager. Good morning, Stu.
Good morning, Tom. How are you?
I'm great. We're getting into spring. I think we're saying goodbye to winter finally, and I'm all about that. So,
well, it's been an interesting couple of weeks because I guess 2 weeks ago was Passover,
yeah,
which was over Saturday and Sunday. This past weekend was Easter,
mm-hmm.
And to me, yes, we're officially in spring, and the weather had been cooperating because this past week, it was beautiful.
Yeah, it was. And you know, it's funny, I guess Easter and Passover is a celebration of a rebirth, you know, all the flowers coming up and the leaves coming to bloom and eggs and birth and all of that stuff. So I always get excited this time of year because it's kind of fun to see all of that stuff happening. And also the things that come around this time of year as far as cooking goes, you know, after the whole, what would you call it, the winter, the kind of... there's a word I'm looking for. It's not in the room, though. I can't seem to find it. The suppressed growing season. Let's try that. And, you know, now all of a sudden I have ramps. I have soft-shell crabs are coming out. I got asparagus. I have spring peas, fava beans, artichokes, apricots. You know, all the things that come out this time of year, spring lamb. It's fun to cook. It's fun to cook this time of year, you know. So we've been enjoying a lot of that at the club. But, yeah, it's a great time of year to cook. And the ingredients that are coming out now are a lot of fun to play with. You know, I just got a bunch of morels in. Have you ever seen morel mushrooms?
No.
They look like those mushrooms in Alice in Wonderland. You know, they're kind of conical shaped with a lot of holes in them, which you have to be careful of because little things can get into those holes, little creatures and dirt and stuff, so you have to wash them out very good. But they're really a beautiful mushroom, kind of on the expensive side, but they have a unique flavor. It's a real musty kind of flavored mushroom that I just love this time of year. And I love the way it looks. It has that, like I said, has that conical sort of shape to it. And all of the little holes, and the holes grab all the sauce, you know, so when you bite into them, you get that extra kind of flow of whatever, you know, vinaigrette or sauce you got with the dish. So it's cool.
It's interesting how you said, you know, you have to be careful how you clean it. It's almost like, I don't know why spinach is like that, but, you know, for some reason, spinach can be sandy sometimes.
Yeah, I think they grow it on the beach. You know what I mean? It's like, it's a three wash system for us. When we get spinach in, we'll wash it and then we'll take it and out of the water. The critical thing for people who are, you know, studying cooking 101 is, you know, when you wash something in water, you're soaking it, you want to take it out of the water and into a colander and not drain the water from it because all the sand is on the bottom. So you want to take the, you know, spinach out or the vegetables out or whatever and do it that way. But spinach, I would suggest washing it three times if you get really fresh spinach because there's a lot of dirt in it.
So let me just ask you in the same line, when people today buy a bagged spinach or bagged lettuce, is it ready to go, or you still have to wash it?
No, the cello spinach is ready to go. It's all been pre-washed and stuff, you know. It's the stuff that comes in the cases that we get, you know, the fresh spinach, you know, on the leaf, on the core and all of that. That stuff is, it's a mess. You have to really clean it up well, you know. And the interesting part about spinach is if you think you need, like, one bag of spinach, get nine. Because once you cook it down, you know, a bag of spinach is about a half an order. You know, it just evaporates to nothing.
Well said, well said. You know, also, there really is nothing worse than having a nice spinach salad.
Oh, yeah.
And when I look at a spinach salad, I see, you know, spinach and maybe chopped egg and some mm-hmm. bacon and some nice
little
dressing.
Warm bacon vinaigrette.
Yeah. But... the same taste. What ruins a meal to me is if you get a scrambled egg or an egg dish and it has a shell in it.
Gagger. It's a gagger. I don't know what it is about eggshells that make me wince, you know what I mean? And I'm pretty, you know, I'm in a business. I'm a pretty brave eater. I've eaten some things that most people wouldn't even look at. But an eggshell is, I have to go to the men's room and stick my finger down my throat and just get rid of it, you know?
So tell me, that be said, why does, when I eat clams, little neck clams, steamers, and, you know, you pull them out of the shell and whatever, and if there's some sand on it, it adds the ambiance.
Yeah, well, that's why they have that little, you know, that little cup of salt water there that they were, you know, whatever they're cooking in the broth, you know.
A butter sauce.
Yeah, you grab the whole of the Chauncey there or whatever you want to call it, and you kind of dip the clam in. And, you know, I have friends that eat that. There's a membrane on the end of that appendage, let's call it an appendage. That's a nice way of saying, you know, the other one. So, but if you kind of hold that, pinch it, and pull with your teeth, that little outside membrane will come off, and you can just toss that away, you know. So anybody who's interested in steamers, eating basic steamer etiquette, you know, that's the way I do it. I eat that. A lot of people just bite that thing off, you know, and throw it away. I like to eat that appendage.
Once you peel it.
Once I peel it, yeah. And so if you hold it right by the base and just with your teeth pull it back, you know, it'll come right off. And I think steamers is one of the, you know, summer gifts that, you know, we have, especially here on Long Island, you know, because I used to dig them up in Bayville when I was a kid. You know, tide would go out and you'd see, they'd call them piss clams or whatever, you know, and they would shoot out the, you know, and you could find them because they were spraying out the
piss
water,
clams.
You know. Yeah, yeah. It's a nice little term, you know. But anyway, I think it's just, to me, sitting by the water, looking out on a canal or something on the South Shore, or looking out on the Sound and, you know, having a bucket of steamers and a steamed lobster, that's just the summer.
So I'm a simpleton. So you get the clams. I assume the clams are closed when you harvest them.
Right.
You steam them in some capacity.
Mm-hmm.
And if you serve a bucket of steamers and something doesn't open, do you try to open it, or that's not
edible? Yeah, well, steamer clams, they're almost kind of half open when you get them. I mean, they're not like regular clams where they're hard. But if you're cooking clams and you get a couple that don't open, just discard them. It means they're probably shot, you know. I mean, that's one of the that and the odor, you know. I mean, you can smell bad clams right away, you know. And oysters too, you know. That's one of the defense mechanisms I think that people have, you know, against becoming really sick with shellfish, is that, you know, once it goes, and it's hard to miss, you know. It has quite a, you know, quite an odd perfume to it.
You know, it's funny. It just brings back memories. I guess Kerry bought a house from a family. The husband was a fisherman and used to take his boys out clamming. I guess,
yeah,
is
sure.
That what you're saying?
Yeah, clam.
And the wife was a real cook.
Uh-huh.
And he would bring home the clams, and anything from, linguine and white clam sauce would happen.
Sure.
Or steamers or baked clams, whatever it was. To me, that's so cool.
Well, I think that, you know, teaching kids early on, whether you're fishing or farming or a vegetable garden, I think it's critical. It's not critical. I mean, it's people who grow up in Manhattan that don't have the ability to plant the garden. But I think it's important to show kids where food comes from. You know, it doesn't come from the supermarket. You know, the supermarket's a stop point, a waypoint, you know, on the way to the consumer. So, you know, if kids see, like, my daughter has a big garden in the backyard out east, and you know, my grandkids, they know where tomatoes come from. They know where, you know, zucchini and all this stuff comes from. They can go out and pick it and bring it in the house, you know. And, yeah, we go shopping, you know, and they go to the store or whatever. But they have a sense of, you know, the earth and where it comes from. And I think that's really important for kids to know that, you know.
Well, it's interesting how in just life, I mean, today we're supposed to accept everything for its imperfections.
Yeah.
But when you go to the supermarket, all you find is perfect tomatoes and perfect cucumbers and perfect melons. And just, again, in life, there's a mixture that not everything is perfect. And when you do home gardening, at least vegetable gardening, I find that, you know, I get the most unusual shapes and and imperfections and colors and errors. But that's what's fun, you know, when you eat an ugly cucumber.
Yeah, it's like people. I mean, you know, all different sizes and shapes of what's make the world go round. But I will inject something there. I mean, when you say you go to the supermarket and see perfect tomatoes, perfect-looking tomatoes, maybe. Perfect tomatoes, I'm not so sure, you know.
You're talking about taste.
Yeah.
And that's texture. The most important thing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, some of the ugliest peaches I've ever seen in my life come from Long Island. And some of those beautiful peaches I've ever seen in my life come from California, you know, on the shelves of the supermarket. The difference in taste that I've experienced is night and day. I mean, I've had the peaches from Long Island to me are much better flavor than not all of them, but a lot of the peaches I see coming up from Chile or South America or California. And I think it's because they're engineered to stay around a while, you know, which I get it. I mean, it's economics. You know, you have to, you don't want the things rotting on the way up. So they engineer them for shelf life. And, you know, how many times you go into a supermarket, like a regular Stop and Shop, I'm just using it as a generic, you know, and you pick up a peach and, you know, when you bang it, it's hard as a rock, you know. You got to take it home and you got to wait like 2 months, you know. It's crazy.
What is it that you call the category of fruit, a peach? There's
stone fruit.
That's what I was looking for.
No ED, stone, E. There's no D on it. Stoned fruit is a different thing. You know? But yeah, it's I very rarely shop in supermarkets. It's usually when I run out of something at the restaurant, I got to run out and get it. And it's frustrating because if you're looking for fruit, it's difficult to find ripe fruit in the supermarket, you know. There's other places. You go to farm stands, that's a whole different story. You know, it's great tomatoes. They have great cucumbers, you know.
I have to chime in. I agree. I think it was last week that we were talking about I like some Jewish soul food on Sunday mornings, a bagel
sure.
and lox
yeah,
with a slice of onion and tomato.
Uh-huh.
And there's nothing worse than asking the deli to or bagel store to give me that to take home, and I put my lox on it, and I get a hard slice, tasteless slice tomato.
Yeah.
And then I go to the supermarket, and I would love to get, this time of year, maybe it's not the right season, but a nice beefsteak tomato that I'll use on my, what's that thing that
mandolin?
Mandolin, and it's so tasty. But it's sometimes difficult, even at the supermarket, especially at the supermarket, to get a ripe piece of fruit. And you got to understand, I guess, when people go to the supermarket, they're buying for the week or whatever. But I'm the luckiest guy because here in Farmingdale, there's a farmer's market every Sunday morning.
Oh, wow.
And I can go over there, and again, I get an ugly tomato that's perfectly ripe.
Yeah.
I cut it, and I'm in heaven.
You know, there's a realness that we seem to have lost here. I'm a big fan of English TV. I don't watch much TV, but my family's from over there, and I get hooked in because, you know, there's expressions that I only hear from my grandparents or my mom, you know. And there's a sense of nostalgia there, you know, when I see all of these things that are filmed in Northern England where my grandparents came from, the Manchester, Liverpool area. And when you look at English television, the difference between English television and American television, other than the abject violence and car chases and silly stuff that blows up and whatever, is that the actors and actresses there, and there's only about 12 of them. I see them on every show, you know. But they're real people. You know, they're not plastic surgeried out. They're not, you know, boobed up. They're not lipped out. You know, they're just, they look like regular, like the rest of us look, you know. And there's a realness there. And it's the same thing with vegetables. I mean, this is probably a stretch as far as an analogy goes. But, you know, you go to a supermarket and you see all these like red tomatoes there. And then, like you say, you try and taste one. It tastes like cotton, you know. It's not their fault. Here's Tom's rule of thumb for all you people out there. And if you're listening to this show, you're probably serious about food. You know, it probably plays a part in your life, you know. Otherwise, you'd be listening to the radio or whatever. If it's not worth the calories, why are we doing it? And that's the only thing you really have to remember the rest of your life. For food, for a diet thing, you know, I mean, if you're on a diet, if it's not worth the calories, why are we eating it? You know, it's just crazy. You know, when I see these tomatoes come in, I mean, I have access to better stuff in odd seasons because there is another season south of the equator, right? So I can get vegetables that are grown in South America, Australia, whatever, you know. So I can sometimes throw a tomato salad on in April or May if, you know, the heirlooms are coming up are good. But I would never use a local tomato, you know, until, you know, local tomatoes aren't available. That's why I wouldn't use them. But if they were, I wouldn't use them until July, August, September. That's height of tomato season. That's when everything, you know, just tastes like a tomato instead of.
So what I have found is that what they call tomatoes on the vine at the supermarket are usually more ripe than the beefsteak or whatever. Although plum tomatoes are usually the least expensive, I find that not the right tomato to put on my sandwich.
No, it's not. You know, plum tomatoes are used for sauces. That's what they're used for. You know, salsas, you know, they're great for pico de gallo or something like that. The tomato salsa that you see all over Mexico and South America. tomatoes to me are, you know, being a fruit, not a vegetable. It's the kind of fruit that, you know, it's like eating a peach out of season. It's like eating a hard, you know, you get those peaches and you're trying it and like it and it's, you're crunching on it. It's just not a peach unless it's soft and running down your arm. You know, that's what a peach is, a peach, you know. So I think the same care should be taken for all the fruits, you know. When they're in season, grab them. When they're out, you know, make an adjustment. Find something that's in season. Or if you're like me and you have access to, you know, different markets, you know, okay. But for the most part, you know, if I would really suggest that anybody who's interested this summer when peaches come in, they usually come in around June, July, you know, go out east and go to a farm stand and buy a bunch of peaches. And I promise you, they're going to be the ugliest peaches you ever seen in your life. But they taste like heaven, man. They're just phenomenal, you know. And that's really the key. I mean, you know, if every one of your friends was, you know, a perfect-looking male model or, you know, female model, I mean, you'd have a boring life, you know. It takes all kinds and sizes and shapes, you know. It's the same with fruit.
So in line with what you just said about the excitement of going out east and eating imperfect fruit, we have been getting a lot of correspondence through email from our many listeners.
And from what I hear, you're an imperfect fruit.
I might be. but I actually would like to just address one that we got. We have one listener, Richard, uh-huh. And I really do appreciate the fact that you wrote to us. I do appreciate your candor, and I do understand that sometimes I might interrupt you, Tom, and for better radio, it's probably best that I let you do your thing. And if you were sitting in the studio today, Richard, you'd see that I'm busy shaking my head and being very physical rather than trying to break into the conversation. So we do enjoy people writing into us, good, bad, and different.
Yeah.
And we respect what you say, and actually it can be a learning experience. So,
constructive criticism is
so
always
so we welcome. Really do appreciate that. We have a listener, Larry, from Long Beach, that's always sending us correspondence, and we appreciate
he's
that.
He's got that soup kitchen down there, right?
And he's involved with it in some kind. And we really should get there.
I will.
But our email address is fire@whli.com, fire@whli.com. Tom does see each and every email that comes in. Myself, Stu, I end up usually being the correspondent writing back, but we've even been getting a lot of pictures. We actually had one listener, and I don't have her name in front of me, but she sent us her complete Easter recipe.
Nice.
But she didn't have time to take the pictures.
Ah, that's too bad.
But my goodness, her description of each and every entree and appetizer and dessert was I was so hungry from reading it. So
it's great to see people so excited about, you know, about making a dinner, or, you know, being involved with food. I mean, I love that stuff. It's obviously my business, but I love it.
So Tom being the focal point of this show, again, rest assured that he does see each and every email, and we would like to continue to exchange information with our listeners at fire@whli.com.
Okay, and I'd like to say one thing. I mean, you know, sometimes Stu jumps in on things, but I welcome that. I think it's a lot of fun, you know, and I think we have a pretty good rapport. I couldn't do the show without you, obviously. So, you know, sometimes we take some weird turns, but I think that, you know, it keeps me on my toes. It keeps me thinking about, you know, A, how to reel you back in sometimes, or B, let's go with it and let's see it. So I appreciate your input here. I just want you to know that.
I appreciate that.
All right. So, you know, going on about spring, I had this, you know, Easter dinner thing going on at the club. You know, it was a lot of fun. And we had three, four seatings, and it was just the limited menu, six, seven entrees and four or five desserts. But I decided that I was going to do something a little different. And, those of you who know me know, probably if you figured this out by now, that I don't think like everybody else. I have a little bit of a twisted sensibility in some of my thought processes. And I'm sure it's either a genetic defect or, there's something up in my brain that doesn't connect the same way everybody else does. So I decided to throw a little fun dessert out there. And I made a pot brownie for dessert for Easter. Now, let me clarify that. The pot brownie, we all know what they are, right? I mean, we're not children, In the 70s, people started baking marijuana at the brownies and getting high. But what I did was I did a tongue-in-cheek pot brownie, and I went out and I went to Home Depot, and I bought these little terracotta flower pots. They're small. They were only about 3 inches, in diameter. And what I did was I seasoned them up. There's no lead in them, if they're not glazed, so nobody has to worry. You actually can bake in them, But you have to season them. So what I did was I painted the inside with oil, like a vegetable oil, and I put them upside down, and I put them in a slow oven for about 3 hours and basically just seasoned the pot. This way, it kind of seals all the holes or whatever. Terracotta is kind of an absorbing sort of material, so we did that, and then I put the brownie mix into the pots, and we baked the brownies in the flower pots. And then when they were cooled, when I got an order, I would just warm it up slightly, because a warm brownie is way better than a cold brownie. I think we can all agree on that. Mm-hmm. And I put a little whipped cream on it, and a beautiful little pansy. So it looked like this little flower coming out of the flower pot, And it was a big hit. Everybody was kind of dug it, It was kind of fun. So the reason I'm telling you this is not so you bake pot brownies, but, there's all kinds of things you can do if you have a little bit of an imagination. And just, some of the things that I'm kind of known for, that chocolate bag thing, which isn't really a difficult technique. And I made it, and it just got so popular, it became like toilet paper on my shoe. I couldn't get rid of it, And I'm not complaining. It's, it's kind of a cool thing. But those are the things that, I always love when people try different things. And my point here is to expand your imagination and just see what you can do. And it doesn't have to be a pot brownie or a dessert. It can be an entree, appetizer, whatever. But take some shots, It's like push the envelope. And you're going to have some failures. I've had some spectacular failures, and I get paid for this. So most of my listeners don't, So have a failure or two. Stu's had a couple of spectacular failures.
No, I'm raising my hand so I can break in.
I love when you behave. Nice. That's so good. Listen, was that Richard who did that? Richard, I'm eternally grateful for you. You've made my life so much easier.
So you said something about pot brownie, but why not a brownie pot? So
it doesn't have the same.
But listen to this one. To start your garden, usually you put seeds in a peat moss pot. So now if this little pot was made out of – was a brownie, and you put whipped cream in it, and maybe fruit and whipped cream or something, that seems interesting. But I have to tell you, this actually might be my last show with you, because you just sparked an idea earlier in the show that just might be my means of – becoming rich.
I've never been more terrified in my life to hear something.
So you talked about potted fruit.
Yeah.
So now in New York State, they're talking about legalized recreational use of marijuana.
Yes.
So we could have fruit-flavored pot.
We could.
I don't know if that's ever been done.
I don't know. I don't know.
I mean, there's fruit-flavored tobaccos.
Are there? I don't chew.
I know people go like... They go to the store and they'll get cigars, I think, that are scented with, cherry and the grape and whatever. I don't know. Just, as they say, food for thought.
Remember what I said? I'm talking to the audience now. Remember what I said before about imagination? All right, just cancel all of that. stick to the basics. I've always wondered why. You take things like and what sparked this thought for me is you're talking about fruit-scented cigars or whatever. And I always thought, when people do that, if the taste of the thing that you had was so good, why did you screw it up with cherries or, you know, what? It's like alcohol, right? Alcohol basically tastes like, you know what? You know, that's why they put 7-Up in it and Coca-Cola and all the other stuff. I mean, by itself, it's rough, you know? And it's the same with, you know, I don't know. I just think that there's a certain purity for enjoying something for what it is. If you like the taste of a good bourbon, you know, why are you throwing Coca-Cola in it, you know?
So that, you're right. But if you go into the liquor store today, all it is about variety. So if you were to get Jack Daniels, there's Honey Jack, there's Apple Jack, there's Fire Jack. You go to Crown Royal, that's the liquor that comes in the velvet. Yeah. There's vanilla, Crown Vanilla, Crown Apple. And even in the soda, the beverage industry, I guess there's a lemon Coke and stuff like that. Now, I know when you have a soda, many times people will put a lemon or a lime in it, but there's definitely a different taste from the natural squeezing a fresh-cut piece of fruit into it than the chemically taste that's included when you buy it. But variety seems to be the means by which brands have been growing in the food and beverage industry.
Oh, yeah. I mean, especially vodka. I mean, there's all kinds of flavored vodkas, and vodka became the largest-selling booze on the planet there for a while. I think a lot of it had to do with the flavorings, which to me tells me that if vodka was so good, if the taste was so good, they wouldn't need it. And, you know, when you talk about garnishing like a Coke with lime or something like that, because I drink a lot of seltzer because I'm always hot. Hear that, ladies? I'm always hot. But no, I'm always, you know, I work in places that are, you know, 130 degrees and higher sometimes. And so we drink a lot of, you know, liquid. And I don't know what it is about. As I get older, I have to count my fruit. You know, it must be some kind of function of aging or something. So I have these quart deli containers, you know, and I drink out of those with a straw. So I have to have 3 limes in a straw. Now, the lime to club soda ratio is critical for me for some reason, you know. And I get annoyed. If she gives me 2 limes, I'm like PO'd, you know. I got to go back out and get another lime. So it's, you know, garnishing a flavor like that is fine. Masking a flavor, you're doing it for a reason. And so, I kind of tend to be a little more of a purist. I mean, you know, I'm fine with mayonnaise and mustard on a sandwich and all that stuff. But let's not put so much on that the flavor of the initial protein or whatever is being masked to the point of unrecognizable.
Well, you just spoke before about mixed drinks. And there's a whole, philosophy that, like...
You didn't raise your hand, you know, by the way.
I apologize. But I was with some young people recently who were, trying to educate themselves. But they found the stash of Gentleman Jack, which is like the step up of the Jack Daniels. And they were ready to mix it. And that's like taking an 18-year-old bourbon and, you know, mixing it with ginger ale or something.
Yeah, my mother taking a Sashanya Monriche and throwing seltzer in it, you know.
It just doesn't seem right. I mean, it's the same with if you were making a mimosa and you were using a $100 bottle of champagne. Mm-hmm. Should you be doing that? But, yes, there's something about being a purist, and especially with bourbon and scotch, from what I understand, some people, if they add water – you know, they get 2 fingers worth of water.
Yeah.
It has to be special water so it doesn't distort the taste of the bourbon or scotch. And then some people, a single cube. And then there's something about taking a stone and cooling it or freezing it and putting it into your drink so that it doesn't
melt. Yeah, it doesn't shut it down, sure. Yeah, they have these fake ice cubes now. You can, I guess they're glass or whatever they're made out of. You freeze those and put them in. I don't know. I used to drink beer 100 years ago. And everything I drink has to be very cold. I don't even like hot coffee. I like it iced, you know, whatever. And it probably comes from all my years in the kitchen when I'm being hot all the time. But when I used to have beer, I used to drink Amstel Light because I could drink 50 of them and feel fine the next day. And, of course, you know, being the abuser that I am. Anyway, but I always had to have ice in it, you know. And, you know, you get your macho questioned every once in a while. You put your water down your beer. Well, alcohol's not going anywhere. It doesn't evaporate, you know. It stays there. It's just colder, you know. And I remember going to England. It was my daughter, and we were in a pub in Manchester watching the World Cup or whatever. And I knew I was going to get it, you know, because they serve beer warm over there anyway, room temperature, you know, cellar temperature. And I'm like, listen, I know you're going to have 60, 70 American jokes here, but have a side of ice. Guy looked at me like it was out of my mind, you know. I just like it cold, you know. And, you know, getting back to what you're saying about, you know, a $100 bottle of champagne and making a mimosa with it, I go both ways on that. If it was my champagne, I would probably switch something out, you know, because I like very good champagne and I would want to, you know, conserve that for myself. But at the end of the day, if it's your champagne, drink what you want. I'm a really libertarian drinker, you know. You drink what you want. You know, the bartender at the club always kids me because I don't knock California cabs, but I do feel that the flavor profile for most of them are very similar. And regardless of cost and pedigree and everything else, I find them to be kind of a linear flavor profile where, you know, they all kind of big juice up front and not a lot of other stuff going on. It's all big fruit. And I get it. I mean, I have a son there every day and, you know, it's, you know, they make the wine that they're given, you know, the conditions give them. But at the end of the day, he'll go to me, you know, oh, we sold a whole bunch of wine tonight. He goes, you're not going to want to hear this, but it was all Napa cabs. I'm like, I don't care. As long as people are drinking what they like, I'm cool with it. You know what I mean? I just think that you should just, if you like big, fat Napa cabs, drink big, fat Napa cabs. If you like Bordeaux's that have some nuance, drink Bordeaux's that have some nuance. If you like the Rhone for the pepper, drink the Rhone for the pepper. And like my mom, if money's an issue, you know, my mother's a box wine girl. She's developed a taste, you know, and she loves it. So who am I to tell her it's a bad idea, you know?
So this week I had the occasion to need a bottle of champagne. Uh-huh. And when I went downstairs to Stu Leonard's, they had anything from $10 a bottle to hundreds of dollars sure. a bottle. I ended up with, it's the suggestion of one of the managers down there. The brand begins with an R, Rotor.
Yeah.
What level of champagne is that? I know they have a number of.
Well, they do. They have a number of levels. You know, I don't know which one you have. But Rotor is a very good name, champagne, they, California. And they make good juice. I mean, you know, there's really no bad juice anymore. You know, I'll give you an interesting one. There's a sparkling wine out there called Gruet, Gruet, and it's made of all places in New Mexico. Now, when you think of New Mexico, you generally don't think of sparkling wine. You think of chilies, you know, kind of Tex-Mex food or whatever, you know, when you're thinking culinarily, you know. But they make some of the best sparkling wine, pound for pound, I've ever tasted. And, you know, my cost on this stuff is, it's low. It's like $12, $13, $14 a bottle. So in a store, you can probably find it under $20, you know. And it's real good. I mean, it's not just good for the money. It's good, period. You know what I mean? The money's a bonus, but you can find things like out there.
So now I'm a little confused, which is not it happens a lot. You said we were talking about champagne.
Right.
You said California.
Right.
That's where I get confused because my understanding is champagne is something that has to come from the Champagne region of France.
Yeah.
But yet we just talked about a California champagne.
Yeah, well, that was probably my misnomer. It's sparkling wine any place in the world other than the Champagne region. But, you know, champagne and sparkling wine has become this interchangeable term for a lot of people. So, technically, champagne has to come from Champagne.
So when then you talk about Prosecco,
right?
And then before the world was all about Prosecco, it was Aste Spumante, which...
Yeah, it's a sparkling wine from Italy.
So what is the difference between a sparkling wine and a Prosecco?
Prosecco is the name of the grape. Prosecco is a sparkling wine, so there's no difference there. But Prosecco is the grape that's used to make Prosecco. You know, it's like Chardonnay.
And a sparkling wine can be made with any type of grape. Again, yes. Prosecco.
Yeah, had sparkling wines that are made with Chenin Blanc, with Cabernet Franc, with Gruner Veltliner, with Riesling. I've had, you know, probably 25 different grapes, maybe. A sparkling wine made with 25 different grapes.
So the brand that I bought, if you can say the name again, Rotorer. I was looking, I guess I fell into the trap. I was looking for something that wasn't cheap, that the people would realize the value of. I found it pretty hard. And now I'm kicking myself because I probably should have gotten a bottle of Sparkling Point because I like to support Long Island and you talk so highly of it. But, like the Rotera that I bought, I believe was maybe not their lowest, not their top. It was about $30, $35 or whatever. But it was interesting because, Vu was like $49 and $89. And I didn't want to go to that level because I thought it was – I didn't think they would appreciate it.
Yeah.
But I didn't want to get the one of the – really low end.
Well, this is where I kind of got to step in because there's an insecurity that happens when people are bringing wine to friends' houses. And there shouldn't be. If you like a wine, you like it for a reason, bring it and stand tall and put your chest out and sit it down on a table, open it up, crack it, whatever. You always have to make a decision. Am I buying this wine to impress other people, or am I buying this wine to give them something that I think is really good? And I see it all the time. I know people who will not bring a Long Island wine to a dinner party. And I've seen people bring lesser wines, especially people who are rating hawks, they watch all these ratings, And you take a vineyard like Pominac, where I make my wines. Pominac has had like 18 or 20 wines rated over 90. There's a lot of California and French that can't say that, by the way. So, but they would rather bring a Chalk Hill, let's say, which is a fine wine, from California, than a Pominac Cab or a Grand Vintage or something like that, which is in the same, money category. And in my humble opinion, a better wine, a more interesting wine. But they won't do it because it says Long Island on it. And they're afraid their friends are going to point and laugh.
Well, I fell into it again yesterday. I needed to go visit a friend who lost their mother to COVID.
Right.
And I wanted to – I knew they were going to get a lot of food. For Jewish people, it's called the Shiva period, and you usually bring a lot of food. But in this world of COVID, I wasn't sure. She's very social individual, so I thought she'd have a lot of people.
Yeah.
But at the same time, what are you going to do with all this food if nobody shows up?
Sure.
I said, it might not be the norm, but I'm going to bring a bottle of wine. So I got torn between Hampton Waters, which is the Bon Jovi
rosé,
and Summer in a Bottle, which is the Wolfer Estates product. The Wolfer Estates product was probably about $24. The Hamptons was like 18. I fell into the trap. I said, well, what would she appreciate? I mean, the Hampton Waters is on its own a pretty nice wine, nice and refreshing or whatever. But it's more meaningful if you know that it's a Bon Jovi product. Yet I'm a big fan of Wolfer Estates, and they have a couple of different rosés. One's not in a flowered bottle, but the summer in a bottle is so beautiful.
It
tastes beautiful. It's refreshing, and I guess it goes back to what you said at the beginning of the show. Spring is here, and you've educated me that rosé can be a very interesting wine.
Real men drink rosé.
So I ended up getting the Summer in the Bottle, but it goes back to what you said. I'm confident with that. I enjoy it, and I like to share my taste with others. And I know that Kerry and Susie had, popped a bottle last summer and was, having a girls' night out or whatever.
Yeah.
So I thought it was appropriate, but there's so much to choosing a wine.
There is. And I don't know. It drives me crazy when I get these people that are just label shoppers. And, like I said, I can tell how much you know about wine by what you order. There's certain, people who are quote-unquote experts on certain subjects. And, if it was a radio question, I would bow to your knowledge. You've been in it forever. If there's a culinary question, I would hope that you would bow to mine because I know a little more about it than you do. And once you get versed in something, like with food or wine or music or anything, you know, the person who, like, if I'm talking to Steve I or Mike Dorio about guitar, I'm kind of humble in my questions. I'm not going to tell them how much I think I know, because they know a ton more than I do, and they can tell what my level is by talking to me. I can tell what a chef's level is by how he writes a menu, by what he does when he first steps in the kitchen. And it's the same thing with wine people. You know, when I go to a table and somebody's asking me about wine, I'll know pretty much right away where they're at, you know, and be able to steer them in a direction, you know. And it's not that it's good or bad or expensive or cheap or, you know, whatever. The only thing that bothers me a little is when I get label shoppers that'll come in, you know, I only drink Big Napa Cabs, or I only drink Screaming Eagle, which is idiotic. I mean, it's $2,500 a bottle. Who only drinks that, you know? But those are the people, and it's not annoying. It's kind of more disappointing, because once you've established that you only drink something, you've eliminated everything else. Like myself, I only date supermodels, right? So once you've exhausted the seven of them that are out there, what are you know? I mean, what are you going to do? It's ludicrous, you know.
What level of wine is layer cake? Did I see that right?
Yeah, well, the name should tell you everything you need to know. You know, look, they make good wine. I don't know how to explain this, but here's the thing in a nutshell: there's no bad wine anymore. There isn't. I mean, 20 years ago, I would taste some wines and, oh my God, what happened to this, you know? Unless there's like a fire in California and they decide to make wine anyway and it's smoky or whatever. You know, you can screw it up that way, I guess. But even some of the stuff like that I really don't drink, like Yellowtail and things that are coming out of Australia that, you know, they're $5 a bottle and they're meant for the masses, they're fine. They taste okay, you know? It's not like you take a sip and you go, oh my God, spit that out. It's awful. There's none of that anymore. So, you know, at this point, drinking what you like is just fabulous, because everything's pretty good.
I heard the name Layer Cake or saw it. Kim Crawford. What are those two?
Kim Crawford makes good wine. She's from New Zealand, and, you know, her wines are, you know, she. I mean, her Sauvignon Blanc, I mean, you see it on TV all the time now, but they're fine. You know, I've had Kim Crawford wines. There's nothing wrong with them, you know.
So there's a new phenomenon that I heard about here in Farmingdale. It abuts the town of Melville, but my friend has a bag company. He actually manufactures vinyl bags. I'm not sure if it's the greatest time for that at this point, when now you go to the supermarket and all you find are brown paper bags, I guess because they're not recyclable.
Sure.
But he introduced me to something a couple of years ago that I was very impressed with, and it brought back memories to me, because I used to be in the manufacturing business, and we used to make products with similar Ziploc bags,
right,
with that type of zipper,
sure,
and vinyl. So he showed me a bag that they had come out with, which was a wine bag, so that across the country there's new laws that allow you to take open bottles of liquor,
sure,
or wine with you. As long as it's in a sealed container.
Yes.
And I don't remember if it was reusable or it was a one-time thing for to make it legal. But I was at a restaurant the other night, and somebody took home their bottle of wine. And I don't know if that's common practice, but it brought up a whole scenario, which is, you know, many times if you're eating out, it's more expensive, obviously, than having a home-cooked meal.
Sure.
But it's part of life and enjoyment.
Yeah,
and
social.
It's social, right. So it came to my thought process that, wow, when I'm in a restaurant, maybe they have a sommelier or they have somebody that's knowledgeable, mm-hmm, about the wine selection, and maybe I would buy up, and if I couldn't drink the whole bottle, the fact that I can bring it home with me made me say, wow, that's a whole interesting concept, because I don't have to overdrink at my meal.
Right.
And yet, again, with a little knowledge, some people are intimidated at the liquor store because there's so much activity mm-hmm. to get assistance. But in a restaurant, it seems to be more one-on-one. So I think that's pretty cool that maybe I would adventure into something that I wouldn't normally. I'd pay a little more because I'm in that frame of mind,
yeah,
but at the same time, you know, I can take it home with me if I don't finish it. And it's just Carrie and I or whatever.
Yeah, well, I have two comments on that. One is that's a phenomenon that's happening more and more because you're allowed to take it home now, put it in a bag, and, you know, if people ask me, would you like to take that, you know, in the car with you and put it in a bag? I said, I'd like taking a car with me and give me a straw, you know what I mean? So how the hell am I going to drink it on the way home if I don't? Kidding, obviously. But the other thing, you know, it's kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? There's you know, they're finally loosening up some of these, you know, the regulations and stuff. And you know, the drinking and driving thing is really a dangerous thing to do. I mean, you know, there's, you know, all kinds of mayhem that can happen, you know, if you're overserved, obviously.
Well, it is amazing that you and I are still here because everybody in our time, it was different and did stupid things. And fortunately, again, we're here. I do love the fact that in today's world, the kids are smarter.
Oh, much smarter.
Just the irony of life is I went to the Islander game the other night with a friend, and my son was taken to the Islander game with a friend. Lo and behold, we're sitting in the same room. My son didn't go. Tell me, it just didn't get coordinated because he needed to be driven there.
Yeah.
Because he thought they would be drinking. But because of the way of the world, you go to the Islander game today. First of all, there's all sorts of regulations. You have to be vaccinated.
Sure,
you have to get a test.
Yeah.
You have to have a health survey. Just a whole bunch of different regulations. Only 1,000 people in the building. But they don't even have concessions open.
Really?
So the creativity is... They used to have like a beer garden outside the perimeter of the building. They have contracted with food trucks to come in.
Okay.
So they have about 6 food trucks that are on the other side of what was the railing for the beer garden and serving food. But there's no liquor to be found, no beer, no hard liquor, nothing. You can get a bottle of water. You can get a cup of soda.
Yeah.
But it was just irony that my son and his buddy, you know, had gotten a ride there. I was going to be driving them home because they were smart.
Right.
And then there was nothing for them to drink.
That's funny. You know, I was surprised to learn, you know, I'm not a big concert goer so much anymore. The only ones I seem to go to is when my friends are playing, you know, the music fair or whatever, or in the city. And I got invited to the Jones Beach, the ZZ Top last summer or summer before. I can't remember. Maybe it was summer before last. And I was surprised and pleasantly so to learn that you can buy a bottle of wine in there. You know, you can buy the whole bottle and they give it to you. They give you a couple plastic cups, you know, so you don't hurt anybody or break any glass. And you know, we had a bottle of wine watching the show. It was fun. You know, it was kind of a...
I have to laugh because I have some friends, Ronnie and Ginny from out east, and we, big Neil Diamond fan and some other, Train. It's very meaningful in their lives. And again, Neil Diamond and Sweet Caroline. But you only can have that bottle of wine in the VIP section. So you're hoity-toity.
I was in the VIP. Who knew?
But they claim that they were the ones that invented bottle service there they normally go out and they drink 1 or 2 bottles. I don't know how they do it, but again,
I can show you.
They're smart and responsible. They actually live out east in Southampton, and wherever they go to their local watering hole, they'll Uber back and forth in today's world. But you know, in the old days, they would have to buy glass after glass of wine. And also there, they sell wine by the can. I know we already talked about your mom's wine in the box.
Yeah.
But at one of the subsequent summers to that first time that I was there with them, they were amazed at the fact that you could get a bottle. And I think what they do now is they actually pour it into some stupid container that looks like a guitar or something.
That's what we had. They put the bottle into some kind of plastic thing.
But they felt, wow, they finally get it here.
Yeah.
You know, there's people that enjoy drinking a bottle of wine, but at the beach it's crazy because you don't get a single beer. It's a tall boy, they call it.
Yeah.
So you're paying for...
It's a beer and a half you're paying.
But yeah, when you're drinking, everything costs a lot.
Sure.
Because...
It's like going to the movies.
You don't want a single... You want a single beer, but you got to buy a tall boy. You want a hamburger, it's a double burger. So you can't even split it because a double burger comes with three pieces of roll.
No, it's funny. I mean, going to movies with my grandkids, you know, and the lady behind the counter buying popcorn, but says, you know, for another dollar, you can have an extra, you know, whatever. I said, for another dollar, I could buy a car, for God's sake, for what it's cost to me.
So two quick retorts. When we go into VIP, Carrie and I, we're big French fry fans.
Yeah.
So if we're having our, you know, tall boy,
yeah, beer and a fry.
We'd like to have fries. Yeah. We have to leave the VIP because you can only get French fries if you order chicken fingers.
Oh, yeah.
So it reminds me of that Easy Rider, was it? When Jack Nicholson Nicholson, and Peter Fonda go into that. He wants a chicken salad sandwich. Well, he wants toast. And they say they don't serve toast. Yeah. So give me...
That was five easy pieces.
Well, I'm sorry. Thank you. Give me a chicken salad on toast and hold the chicken salad.
Well, I have a quick story about that. We have a few minutes left. So I went to a restaurant, and it'll remain nameless because it's not important. But I go there, and I sit at the bar like normal. You know, that's where I like to eat. And it was a two-story restaurant, right? So the bar's upstairs. I'm sitting up there, and I said, can I see a menu? You know, so the guy hands me the bar menu. So I said, okay, can I see a regular menu? He says, I can show it to you, but I can't serve you anything off the regular menu. I'm like, how come? He says, well, this is the bar, and we have a bar menu up here. I'm like, yeah, I know, but, you know, I'm looking for the regular menu. He says, well, we don't serve the regular menu up here. And I'm like, well, why not? He says, well, the chef doesn't think he can really experience his food up in the bar. I'm like, okay, why don't you tell him to get over himself and, you know, kind of thing. I was starting to get annoyed. So I look across the bar, and they had, you know, sometimes when you go to a better restaurant, they'll have a big, like, bucket or vase kind of thing where they'll put ice and the white wines in, you know, that they're serving by the glass. So I look over, and all Austrian wines, on the top of the cap, and they're mostly screw caps, but on the top, it's white with a red stripe, you know, and you can identify it right away. So I see one across the bar, and I'm like, oh, what's the, you have an Austrian wine there, you know, what's in that bottle? He says, a Grüner Veltliner. I said, okay, I'll have a glass of that. He said, I can't give you that because that's the wine for downstairs. Now, I'm half incredulous and half homicidal at this point because I can't get anything I want, you know. So I'm like, so let me understand this. You can't give me a glass of that wine because that wine's on the menu for downstairs. Yes. Why don't you just sneak me one? I won't say a word. How's that? You know, no. So I'm getting mad. Now I'm getting, you know, banged under the table. Behave, Thomas, you know. So anyway, we go downstairs, right, to have dinner. And the hostess says, and there's four people in the dining room. It's a Sunday night, right? Will you be joining us? Well, I don't really have a choice, do I? You know? So we sit down. I order a bottle of wine. It's corked. I send it back. You know, sir, sommelier, is sommelier here? Yeah. So this 12-year-old comes to the table, right? And he's sniffing this, that, and the other thing. You know, this wine is reductive. So I said, listen, spare me the speech, all right? It's corked. Bring another one, and we'll open up to both of them side by side. And if they taste the same, I'll buy both wines. Yeah, how's that? Okay, fine. So he brings the wine now. Okay, I see that, you know, I get the wine. There was a truffle supplement on one of the dishes, and I don't remember. I think it was scallops, right? So I said, we're going to have the scallops with the truffle supplement. So the waiter says, well, there's a problem with that. We don't have any more truffles. I said, that's a shame. She goes, yeah, you know, the truffle truck didn't come today. And I said, I didn't realize they had one of those. Yeah, yeah. We got our truffles from out east. Eastern Italy? Or, you know, I mean, no, the truffle truck comes, but it's not coming until tomorrow, right? So now this is a Fellini movie. I mean, I'm thinking there's a friend of mine somewhere punking me, you know what I mean? And he's looking out from the, you know, under the kitchen counter or whatever. So we get the dinner. Now, the guy who's sitting across from me with his girlfriend gets up, comes to my table, and says, I understand you wanted the truffle supplement on your scallops. I said, yeah. So he goes, well, you know the reason they don't have the truffles? I said, I don't, other than the fact that the truffle truck didn't show up. He goes, no. We had a tasting menu for my girlfriend and I because we just got engaged, and the chef had truffles on almost every dish that we put out. It was fabulous, this, that, and the other thing. But I understand that they're going to have some truffles tomorrow. I said, oh, well, thanks for the tip. So the girl comes by, and she says to me, yeah, I checked again. There's no truffles, but we're going to have truffles tomorrow. I said, well, okay, well, the problem with that is I'm here now. You know what I mean? I'm not coming back tomorrow, you know? Anyway, like, long story short, I was with Gene at the time, and Gene turns around to me, and she goes, who was that guy that just came over about the truffles? I said, I don't know. She goes, you don't know him? No, he's a stranger. I mean, it was the most insane restaurant experience I ever had in my life, you know? I'm like, check, please. You just get me out of here, you know? It's
so
nuts.
Before we leave today, two quick stories. One is Jolly Fisherman Restaurant in Roslyn. We've had some fun with that over the years. But I actually, kudos to them, because I recently heard that they, on their menu, have a deluxe seafood cocktail, which is interesting because it's a combination of usually what's three single entrees, appetizers. But their deluxe seafood cocktail is jumbo shrimp, lobster meat, and lump crab meat.
Yeah.
That's phenomenal.
It's going to be $60.
$32.
All right, well, that's fair.
That's enough, seriously, that I want to go back and visit. So
yeah,
that's
for sure.
Number one. I just, in just before we leave, had dinner at a nice Italian restaurant, upscale, Matteo's, in Huntington. Beautiful. I guess it's owned by the Scotto brothers, because when I left with some food.
There's different factions of that family, you know.
Yeah, yeah. But this had Matteo's on one side, and the bag said Rothman's on the other.
Yeah.
So I thought there was a Zabarro deal there.
That's Jerry Zabarro.
But somehow, whatever. But what do you do when somebody orders a bottle of wine, uh-huh. you feel they're knowledgeable,
right.
and they ordered a Chianti or something,
right.
came to the table, it had a screw top.
Mm-hmm.
He refused it. They didn't open it yet, but he goes, oh, this is not what I thought it was. I need a cork.
That's somebody who knows nothing about wine, because you're better off with a screw cap than a cork, because there's no chance of the screw cap being corked.
Well, it quickly went to me. I think Conundrum, which I guess is the
it's
lower
made by
loin.
Caymans.
I think that is a screw top.
There's a lot of screw caps out there.
And it cost me about $20-something at the liquor store.
No, it's perfectly acceptable. I mean, Stelvin caps are what they call them. Ensure that the wine doesn't spoil. I mean, you know, that's the reason they're doing it. They're not doing it. It doesn't cheap wine. I mean, I bought bottles of wine, $70, $80 bottles that have screw caps, so it has nothing to do with the quality.
The perversion of my mind is I went to a wedding a couple of years ago, and I guess they see people sometimes by age, in a sense, you know, because the cousins and the uncles are older. So the table next to me, the 80-year-old guy is trying to open a screw top bottle with a corkscrew.
Oh, I've seen that. It's hilarious. You know,
I really respected them. They're wonderful people. I guess I had met them during the cocktail hour, mm-hmm. and I had to gently
twist
the situation.
All right. So on that note, we're going to twist out of here. All right. We're going to end the show with Tom's three keys to life. Like normal life is too short to drink bad wine. Treat every meal like it was your last, and keep chocolate in your life as important as sex and pizza. And I got it right this week.
Fire at WHLI.com.
Look forward to hearing from you.
Amano Osteria and Wine Bar has been created by Adam Lovett and Tom Shaudell to bring the feel and flavors of a true Tuscan Osteria to the North Fork. Amano showcases local growers, farmers, cheese, and winemakers, marrying their ingredients with the taste traditions of the Tuscan countryside. The casual appeal, the flavors of Italy, and a moderate price structure appeal to all, ensuring year-round patronage. This North Fork eatery sends out snappy salads and seafood, pastas and antipasta, along with a respectable wine list. Amano features local vineyards and Italian varietals from the U.S. and Italian wines. The kitchen remains open until 11 and has established a later dining crowd, sparking a local nightlife dining scene. Amano is on the cutting edge of a new high-quality and affordable dining experience on the North Fork. Amano Osteria and Wine Bar, 13550 Main Road in Matatuck. Serving dinner daily, Amano is also open for lunch on Saturday and Sunday. For reservations and further information, call them at 631-298-4800 or visit them on the web at amanorestaurant.com.